Hello, everybody. Welcome back again to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, we are here. We are at the pinnacle of our Tom Cruise-a-thon. We did two Mission Impossible movies and one non-mission movie.
Well, we did. Yes. Yeah.
We did
Minority Report. Three Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah. Three Tom Cruise movies. And I'm glad we did it because the guy is... Look, and I'm not speaking about his personal life.
Yes.
I'm not speaking about his religious affiliation.
Yes.
I'm not speaking about the jumping on the chairs at Oprah. As an entertainer, yeah. As an actor,
yeah,
he's one of one. He's there's just nobody quite like him. No. And he's got like the best movie star name of all time.
Yeah. And that's not even his real name.
Of course not.
No, but it's so good.
Tom Cruise.
I think it's his middle. Well, was it his middle name?
Tony Jetpack. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, like,
what a name.
Yeah. What are you talking about? No, but Tom Cruise he's the guy, man. Like he's been there our entire lives.
Oh yeah.
He's been doing this. Yeah. And this franchise really is something. I tell you.
It really is. He set out to make something that was kind of all his own and that featured everything that he's really good at. First of all, running.
Yeah.
Every movie, there's a lot of running, which is good. He's a very good runner. But it also, I mean, it shows a lot of range as far as his acting abilities, but then it shows his stunt work, like everything that he does. And that's what's so great about these movies is they are good stories. They're solid, really well-made stories, but they have so much fun in them. This is like everything great about a blockbuster. This is everything you want from a blockbuster. It's fun. It's got a good story. There's definitely cheesy parts.
Yeah.
There's definitely things that don't hit perfectly, but it's all done really, really well. Everybody's giving their best. Everybody's giving into it, and they make the movies that they want to make. I love these movies.
I love these movies, too. And, you know, as maybe outlandish as elements of the plots of the different movies can get, where they always have to kind of heighten. Like I just watched the first movie the other day and it's like fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
It's just like they don't always feel the need to be like, we need to up the ante of how can this situation get even crazier and even crazier. And there's plenty in there. I mean, he jumps onto a helicopter from a speeding train that's already in a tunnel and blows it up and then jumps back onto the train. And then a helicopter propeller comes inches from it. You know, like they were definitely in a heightened space from the very jump.
Oh, yeah.
But it feels like successively with each film, they go more and more with their big kind of set piece, like central, like big action set piece of like, how can we, you know, like with Fallout, with the helicopter dogfight, it's just like, how can we push it up more and more? How can we keep intensifying the peril and and I feel like sometimes audiences kind of check out on stuff like that because they feel like there's no stakes here. I know Ethan Hunt's gonna win. Or when you're watching like a James Bond movie, it's like, I know it's gonna happen. James Bond's gonna win. I'm not afraid that he's not going to win. The reason why this franchise is so special is because there are real world stakes at play. And even though we all know before we go see the movie that Tom Cruise definitely survived the shooting process, when you're watching these sequences that feel ridiculous or feel outlandish or feel like they're pushing it too far, you constantly have to remind yourself, wait, but this is the guy that actually figures out how to do it.
Yeah.
And so in a way, this franchise is like the story of Tom Cruise's life. Yeah. And each movie is an impossible mission of its own, where it's like every movie they set out to do something that they shouldn't be able to do, that you should, like where they're like, oh, what if we tried this? And then if you actually study the story of these films, they always get people who come back and go, here are 10 very good reasons why you can't do that.
Yeah.
Why that's impossible. And then Tom Cruise and his team figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, but that's what happens in the movies is like, they go, well, here's what we want to do. And people go, you can't do that. That's impossible. And they go, well, we're going to figure out how to do it. And then they do it. But then like these movies are, it's like, that's this franchise.
Yeah.
Is them again and again and again, figuring out how to do the impossible.
Yeah. and making it look great, and Tom putting his life on the line. I mean, they're as careful as they need to be. They're all very, very careful, but still he's putting his body on the line and everything on the line to make these movies what they are. And they're all with his insurance company, because he has to be insured. He has to be covered. And his insurance company, it seems like every story is like, oh yeah, the insurance company didn't want to cover this, but we found a way. And I just talked him into it. And it's like, I can't believe you did that. Like, that is.
Yeah. Paramount and Skydance and these companies that are funding these films are funding them to the tune of several hundred million dollars a pop. So when your star is going, I might not make it through the shoot because I want, because of this thing I want to do, that's a lot of money that's invested into this thing. That's gotta be, there's gotta be an insurance policy on it. Yeah. Of how do we get our, how do we recoup if Tom dies? Because every movie, it's what if Tom dies? And every time, it's not just like a, there was an outside chance. It's like, no, there's a very good chance. Like when he hung off a plane in Rogue Nation, they were like, yeah, at this speed, a projectile could hit you and kill you.
Yeah.
If there's just like something caught.
If you get hit by a bird.
A bird, a pebble that's flying fast enough that gets caught in this wind stream could break through your skull or break the skin, like, or seriously injure you. And then while you're hanging on to the plane and you're only tethered to the plane by a single wire, let's say you do get hit by a pebble and it like knocks you out. And then you're like dangling by the wire and slapping against the side of the fuselage. Like, you're dead, you know? And that happened in Dead Reckoning, the big major stunt that's in all the trailers and on all the posters. Like, he was tethered to those planes by one wire. And it was just a wire that they would tether his harness to. But it's like, if he's still the one gripping the plane. He's still the one holding on. And if he loses his grip, he's just swinging by a wire from this plane. And
You mean the final reckoning?
The final, this latest
one. In the end of this one, we will get to that, but
we will get to that. But it's like, when they wanted to climb the Burj Khalifa, they went to the building, and the building was like, oh, it turns out you can't, there's not really a way to rig the cameras the way that you want to do it. So you might just have to like, and obviously most productions would just go, okay, can't do it. Like, it's just not possible. Because what they had to do was physically alter the structure of the building so that they could, they had to blow out 26 windows and remake the structure of the building to accommodate camera rigging. And it's like, okay, cool. Most productions would just go, oh, it can't be done. Like, we will go and build a replica of the exterior of the Burj Khalifa in a studio and then green screen in the image of, you know, Dubai below. And that's how most people would do that. But they were just like, no, we're just going to do whatever it takes to do it in camera. And that
it
crazy.
Really, it, yeah, it really makes it so much more immersive. And again, like, every, this is one of the things about the whole series is like, all right, which stunt did Tom Cruise do in this one? And then everybody says, oh, he did that for real. Like, he did that, he, you know, and it's, it makes it so much more of a, it makes it so much more engaging because, you know, it's not green screen.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they're obviously doing shots in there that kind of fill in, but it, it just makes it so much more fun to watch these movies. I love them. They're great.
Let's get into this one. There's a lot to talk about. If you have there not is. Seen Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, it's in theaters right now. Please go see this one.
Yeah,
on the biggest screen. You can go see it in IMAX. Go see it on the, I mean, it is just, they've earned it. They've earned your money.
They have. And you know, we got to say, we, this was one of our predictions.
Yeah.
This movie. I can't remember exactly. I said for sure it was going to make $1 billion. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I did think, I think I said that I didn't think this was going to be the best one, but I think it was going to be a really good ending. I'd have to look back again, but I think I was right. I think,
yeah, I think my prediction was something like that, where I was like, I don't really ever dislike these movies. I'm always down for the ride. I don't think that they're ever like, you know, life-changing cinema or anything, but boy, is it fun. And I had such a good time watching this last installment. This was in many ways the Avengers Endgame of the Mission franchise. Where they're really trying to do that thing where they're trying to pull it all together. And they've got a lot of threads, and not all of them make it in there. You know, Jules doesn't make a comeback or anything, but I think we've kind of settled the Jules storyline in Fallout.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the amount that they do manage to bring back in I found impressive, and it yeah. felt pretty, for the most part, well balanced.
It did. You know? Yeah, it felt very natural, and it all culminated. It definitely didn't feel like they were shoehorning anything in. I felt like it did all close the series very, very well. It did tie up some loose ends, you know, especially with Mission Impossible 3, which we reviewed last week, which we'll get to. But that was a really interesting way to bring 3 back into it. But there's still a lot of side characters that we don't really get a complete close to, but that happens. But the main people, you know, it was a very satisfying ending. And I felt like this is a good way to end this franchise.
And we'll talk more about that later too, because I hope it is the ending. And
that's true. That's right. That was the other thing that we said.
Right.
Because I don't think this is going to be the ending of the movie, the Mission Impossible movies, but
I hope it's the end of the Ethan Hunt storyline starring.
Yeah,
Tom
me
Cruise.
Too. Yeah.
I hope that not necessarily because I'm tired of him or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mostly just because I like stories to have an ending.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just don't really like it when something just goes on and it feels like if they keep going, it's like, well, it's kind of like when an athlete has an amazing career and they don't know when to hang it up.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, it's like those bonus Michael Jordan years where you're like, I kind of wish you didn't go play for the Wizards or like, I wish Karl Malone didn't play for the Lakers for a couple seasons. You know, it just feels like it sort of like puts this taste in your mouth where you're like, you had such a special career and you did so many cool things and you could have just ended it on a really nice note and gone, that's a nice round shape to my professional playing days, but you couldn't, you just needed to squeeze a few more million dollars out of and then the ultimate ending is like, it's kind of anticlimactic, you know?
Yeah.
And to be able to end a story, a 30-year franchise like this on a note like this, I'm like, take the W.
Yep.
It's Tom Brady winning the Super Bowl with Tampa Bay. It's like, dude, retire. Take it.
End it.
You did it, dude. Like you went to a whole other team and you had, you know, and proved that you could do it without Belichick. Take it and quit. Yeah. And he didn't.
Yeah, he didn't. So let's hope this is the end for him, for Ethan Hunt.
Right.
Because that is it's a good way to end it. Good way to close it out.
Yeah. Okay. So this movie, I right off the bat, I really liked. I got to say, throughout the entire movie, I loved the score. I thought, it's a woman, I think, that did the score for this one, and I'll have to look. But I noticed, because I just went and watched the first one again, she does a thing with the Paramount logo coming in that basically is mimicking what the first one did. So the first, because I was like, oh, that kind of sounds like a marching band. Like it's like this snare drum and it sounds like it's like this really like, and I kind of thought we were going to open the movie on like a marching band or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then we didn't. And I was like, oh, weird choice. But that's actually exactly how the first one starts. The first one starts with that snare drum. And I was like, oh, she was doing an homage to round out the edges of this franchise to the score for the first one.
And yeah. So the composers were actually Max Arouge and Alfie Godfrey.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I do like this opening. I did like the score for this one for sure.
I misgendered our composers, but I loved how big it was for the entire thing.
Yes.
It was so unapologetically big. The score for throughout the entire movie was so like there and present and I liked it. I was like, I'm glad that it's here. We start the movie with Ethan watching basically a recap tape. It's basically like last time on Mission Impossible.
Last time on the previous 7 Mission Impossibles.
Yeah, previously on Mission Impossible. And he puts it in like a VHS tape. And that's a big thing in this movie is analog tech versus, you know, digital modern AI tech. And that's a big theme in the film is Tom Cruise is kind of a movie star from the analog era, and the way he likes to do things is we are entering an era of filmmaking where you will be able to make photorealistic stunts for films using fully AI generated animation. Mm-hmm. And it will look within 2 to 3 years, it will look completely unmistakable. And he prefers to do it real. prefers to do it analog style. And that's sort of a big commentary being made in this film kind of throughout, is like, we do it the tactile way. And so, like, you know, but yeah, this VHS kind of takes us through this. It reminds us the story and the stakes of the previous film, because this is sort of a two-parter, this reckoning.
Right. Right.
Duology.
Yeah. And this is all from Angela Bassett, mm-hmm. who is the president now. She was the director of the CIA. Now she's the president. And I really like Angela Bassett, and I actually like her character in these movies. Like, she's really good in these last three or four that she's been in.
Oh, we've got a fantastic supporting cast
in
this movie and in the last several movies.
Yes.
Everybody's bringing it, especially in this last one. I was like, everybody's really taking advantage of their moments.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if this movie's going to have a common criticism that you're going to see from a lot of critics, it's going to be that the first act of the film is very exposition and flashback heavy.
Yep.
And I've been sitting with this and thinking about it, because I was watching it going, okay, the flashbacks are getting a bit much.
Yeah,
we're doing a lot of them. Even as Ethan is watching this tape, he's flashing back to previous movies and thinking about previous missions and all this stuff. And it did, like, after like 40 minutes of that, I was like, okay, on rewatch, this is probably going to be a little bit laborious, all the flashbacks.
Yeah.
But I was also like, you know, if you just tried to do a movie like this that's trying to tie up a 30-year franchise, mm-hmm. and you just assumed that everyone remembers everything that's happened in all eight films, I don't think you can. And I heard Christopher McQuarrie talking about this on a podcast. He's like, we cut it so many different ways, and we realized sometimes you just got to tell them.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, and I was like, I was thinking about it. I was like, in Avengers Endgame, the way that they did it for us is they did the time travel storyline.
Right.
So they basically traveled through the MCU, and they did like a visual history of them, you know. And again, it's like, what they're doing there with a story device is like, remember this from Thor, the Dark World, and remember this from, you know, and we're going on kind of a journey through the films. Remember this from the first Avengers movie. And and maybe that's a but like, you can't really do that in Mission Impossible. You can't have Ethan Hunt time traveling through the films.
No, no. And yeah, it really, I mean, it is a recap. They at least make it, it was fun. I think the nice thing about this on rewatch, when you get it in, when you stream it, you could just skip over a lot of this.
Yeah.
You know, but it is a good way to remind you of everything. It is very, very exposition heavy. But in this type of movie, you kind of have to, like you're saying, it just kind of has to happen just to get everybody kind of situated where you're supposed to be and oriented to the story of the entire franchise. And, you know, Angela Bassett is kind of telling Tom Cruise, you know, like, oh, you did this, you know, and goes through everything. One important thing she brings up, well, there's two important things. One thing is she says that there's the entity has created like a cult. And there are like these what do they call them? They're followers that are just completely, they're into it, right? I
kind of wish the movie had done more with this, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's a very, more of a red herring, but yes.
But it's a very interesting thing to bring up. And then the movie doesn't really have anything. They don't wind up. Maybe they shot scenes. I'm sure they did. Christopher McQuarrie always talks about how much they shoot for these films.
Well,
maybe they shot more scenes with the cult members.
I mean, the one thing is in the submarine.
Yep.
That's the big thing. And then they do kind of a red herring. At least I felt it was a red herring with what's his name? At the end with the president.
With Nick Offerman.
That definitely seemed like it was going to be that, but they definitely could have done more. It actually, but
it's a
movie this big.
Listen, I actually find the idea of the entity utterly terrifying, because we are no longer in the era where this is like some far-fetched sci-fi. You know, maybe in the future someday. We are literally living through it's so weird. Like, what I kept thinking the whole time I was watching this movie in the theater is, wow, the stakes are, I'm really feeling the stakes of this film. And it's hard to do in a movie where you know the ending, kind of like Avengers Endgame. It's like, we know they're gonna win, even though they lost in Infinity War. It's like, we you know, but the fact that they can make Thanos an imposing enough threat that you still feel like I bet some of our main characters aren't going to make it out alive. Like, there's a possibility that even though Ethan's team's going to win, I don't know that Ethan's going to win or make it out, you know? And also the idea of this entity, which is basically this AI that is has evolved to the point where it does so many projections into the future using calculations and algorithms that it can basically predict what people are going to do. Yeah. And it's scheming and making plans. And in this movie, it's kind of uncoupled itself from Gabriel, our villain from the previous film. And it now wants to infiltrate all of the world's nuclear arsenals.
Yeah. It's so interesting because this, so this movie and Seven, Dead Reckoning, and this are very connected. I felt like the way that they used the entity in this movie was far more effective than the way that they did in the last movie.
You meant Mission Impossible 7. I thought you meant the movie 7. And I was
sorry.
I was like, Dead Reckoning.
You're going to have to walk me through this one. No, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning was definitely, they're connected. So the entity comes up in 7. And I just didn't ever feel like it just seemed like a 50s view of AI. And in this one, it's like, it's changing. You don't know what photos are real. You don't know who, you know, what information is real. And that's such a present problem that we have right now. Like, you know, the Pope with the puffy coat, so many people thought that was a real image and it was an AI generated image. And so it's like, okay, this feels so much more tangible than the last movie. So I really liked a lot more.
But I don't even think that they changed the presentation of the entity all that much. I think what's changed is our understanding of our relationship to artificial intelligence. So in the years between Dead Reckoning and The Final Reckoning, a lot has happened with AI.
Yeah.
And continues to happen, where now when we have the idea of an AI getting to the point where it goes, oh, I actually kind of have a sense of self-determination and I want to start making plans for myself. And we think about the idea of an AI infiltrating nuclear silos. It actually feels like something that could potentially happen in the next 5 years.
Right.
And that's a really scary thing to kind of existentially confront while you're watching this movie. And I was definitely sitting there going, this is no longer like some far-fetched, you know, kind of silly idea. This is like,
it's true.
You know, like, I think increasingly we're going to be telling stories about our fears surrounding AI.
Yeah.
And we're going to, we're reckoning with the new world that we live in, you know?
Yeah.
Ethan's got to take on the entity in Gabriel, which means they, throughout this whole entire movie, they kind of have to use analog tech. And they've got to really be careful about what devices they're communicating on and things like that, because the entity is kind of ever present. And that makes it, I feel like they, for a movie where you know that the heroes are going to win, I feel like they did a really good job of keeping a sense of dread throughout.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And they use it. And early on they do, which we'll get to, they up the stakes in a sad but good way. Which I mean, this happened, I don't remember how early on this is, but yeah, basically Ethan gets this directive from the president saying like, please help us, you know, and she's like, she's on his side, which we established at the very beginning. She is on his side. She wants him. She feels he's the only one that can really make this all happen. And they need him to bring in the cruciform key that he found from the last movie.
Yeah.
You need to come in and you need to fix all of this.
Yeah. The mission that she's giving him here is please come in and give us the key.
Yeah.
And he doesn't immediately accept. He decides, no, I gotta go. What I like about these two movies, Dead Reckoning and Final Reckoning 2, is like the need to be like anything that we would normally do, the entity would probably predicted we would do. So we always have to take see that again and again in the action sequences, like Ethan making decisions that don't really make sense because he's like, the only way to do it is the least likely way. And again, it's like the theme of this franchise where it's just like, oh yeah, the only way to, kind of the theme of the franchise is we have to do something impossible and there's only one way to do it right. And we've got to get it, you know, just right. And you know, but even more so here, Ethan's got to sort of outthink this machine that's like, I already know what you would do based on your file and your previous history. And so he's always trying to stay one step ahead of it. And early on, he's struggling to do that. He decides to go to this party where they think Gabriel might be, because they found out Gabriel and the entity have kind of split up.
Well, I guess this happened in the beginning with the videotape. We find out what the rabbit's foot is.
That's right.
We find out that the rabbit's foot from Mission Impossible 3 was an early version of the AI entity. That is the entity now.
Yeah.
Right. And how did you feel about that? What did you think about that reveal?
I'm fine with it. I think that it always felt to me like the rabbit's foot was like a biological weapon.
Yeah, because it has the symbol on it.
Yeah, the way that it's canistered. But I also could see, I like the idea of them doing that as a misdirect, that they package it in a way that looks like it's something other than it is. And what it actually is this thing that they knew from the jump had the potential to be a world-ending kind of like whoever controls this AI and controls this algorithm will basically be able to do whatever they want. And I like that. I like that. Like, I mean, if you're going to call something the anti-god, it should be this thing that truly has the power to end all life on Earth.
Yeah. And I think, I agree. I agree with you. At first I was kind of like, well, that's kind of dumb, 'cause I thought it was biological, but you know, after a while it does, you have the, I mean, JJ Abrams never thought of this, right? They never, obviously they retconned it a little bit, but the fact that they set up the clout of it being an anti-god, this was a good way to kind of like give it even more stakes and even more gravitas to what the entity really is, right? Like he took, like there was so much, there's so much clout around it with Benji talking about it being the anti-god. So I was like, okay, yeah, that's a pretty good way to like,
sure,
see how important it was. So I thought, okay, that was pretty cool. And I was glad that we actually reviewed Mission Impossible 3, because it really, that one feeds in the most probably to this movie that's outside.
They're connecting a lot of dots throughout the entire franchise and showing how lots of different, you know, and mostly I think it works, you know. So Ethan goes to this party to get Gabriel. Yeah. And pretty quickly, he and whatever the girl's name is, Agent Carter.
Yeah, Haley Atwell's.
Haley Atwell.
Grace, yeah.
Yeah, and they get detained by Gabriel's people and taken in. And, you know, they're prisoners, which we've seen Ethan in this situation at the beginning of several films, you know, where he's, yeah, how are you going to get out of this one? You know, long story short, there's not really much here other than like they're going to come in and torture them, and Ethan breaks out and he and Grace beat up the bad guys, and you know, Ethan kills them. And I kind of liked this, like the whole, like just having the camera on Grace's reaction to Ethan, you know, using these weapons. Guys.
Like, because you see all the weapons, and then she's just like, oh, and then he comes in with blood, and that was pretty funny.
Yeah, he's got blood all over his shirt, and you know, and they've always got to find a way to get Tom Cruise shirtless to remind us, like, hey, even at 62, check it out. And we're like, he's still, look at him go.
Yeah, you know? Which I got to say, okay, so actually one of my friends commented on our last video. And so Tom Cruise is 62. Ian McKellen was 62 when he starred in Lord of the Rings. That makes no sense to me. Like, how are these two people the same age when they made these movies?
I'll tell you why. America. Because America number one, all right?
Yep.
Ian McKellen's one of those godless Brits. Like, you can't keep up with... Ian McKellen's not keeping up with Tom Cruise. Yeah, all right? Yeah, yeah. You know, they're eating beans and toast over there. He's not keeping a six-pack. America.
right.
Yeah.
But that was crazy to me. But yeah, he takes off his shirt. He's still... very physically fit person, way more than I am, but good fun sequence.
They break out, Gabriel's running away, the chase is on, and it kind of looks like Gabriel's almost led them to the entity, like he wants them to go, or the entity, maybe it's the other way around, maybe the entity, because the entity kind of locks them out of being able to continue chasing Gabriel, and then they look, and there it is, this box that Gabriel used to use to talk to the entity, and it's like, Ethan's like, all right, I'm gonna get in there. Which is like, also, I was like, dude, crazy. Anything could happen in there. This thing could just zap your brain and kill you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why it doesn't, you know? And again, this was kind of another thing where like homegirl that is Mantis from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Clementif.
She's like, careful, it changes you, you know?
Yeah.
And
which she died in the last movie.
Yeah.
Like, she was so dead in the last movie. Like, I was like, which I like her. I actually like her character and I like her as an actress.
Yeah.
But I was like, my son, because I took my son to this, just me and him, and he's like, didn't she die? And I was like, yes. Yes, she did.
Yes, she did. I don't care what they say. Yeah, but they have her back here, and she's like, careful, it changes you. And I was kind of hoping, again, for another little bit more of a payoff on that. Same thing with, like, the cult. I'm like, that's an interesting thing to set up. And I think that, I can see a future where there is an AI that this is already happening, by the way. There is already a movement amongst young people of just letting ChatGPT dictate their lives. I literally have had, this is a real thing. I've had young people ask me, they'd be like, so all my friends are just, the way that they go through their day-to-day life is they just ask ChatGPT what they should do and then they just do it. How do I get them to stop doing that? And I'm like, I don't know, dude. I'm like, what are you talking? Like, because to me, that's like just the most moronic thing I've ever heard. Yeah. But that is, as AI gets better and better at feeling like it's got good answers about things, this is going to become more and more common. There are going to be humans who want to unburden themselves from the problem of having to think having to like reason their way through life. And they're just going to go, I'm just going to ask this super smart bunch of coding of millions of lines of code what I should do. And it'll probably have a better idea than I could come up with. And I'll just do that. And with that is like, if this thing started trying to take over the world, you'd be like, hey, listen, I'm with you. And you could, I just don't think it's actually that far-fetched of a concept. And I'd like to see more of it in this film. And this is another area where she's like, it changes you, where I'm like, I'd like to see how somehow Ethan Hunt going into this machine, I think we do sort of see it in the movie that he seems to understand the entity better this.
Yeah.
But I wonder about like, I don't know, like something that he's struggling with that it show like, or
yeah,
you know, but maybe, yeah,
it just kind of, it does seem to influence his plans of like how severe everything is and like how urgent everything is.
Yeah. But and
they could have definitely gone into it more.
Yeah. And we do get we get more flashbacks here. We get more, you know, the entity is showing him scenes from previous movies and things like, and then showing him possible futures and things like that. He gets out and he seems to have a better understanding of what needs to be done after he has seen kind of the entity's game plan and end game. And again, once again, Ethan is the guy who sees the path through the narrow path, but it's just like this. It's kind of like Doctor Strange in Infinity War, where it's like there's this one in like 14 million
and five,
whatever it is. Like there's this one path, and it's highly unlikely, but if anyone can do it, it's Ethan and Benji and the gang.
Yeah, and they really set this up, as the impossible mission. Everything they have to do, which I actually really liked that. I was like, I'm in, let's do it.
Yeah, I loved when like people would recount when he just as part of in order to get this done, like he just has to tell people what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then they're like, sorry, you're going to do this, then this, then this, then this. And he's like, mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, that's insane. But it's like, well, the world's going to end in a few days. So, you know,
and it is. They continue to remind you of the stakes.
Yeah.
Which are good.
Yeah. Ethan realizes that Gabriel's probably going to go after Luther. We established this earlier in the film that they have sort of an underground base in London where Luther is set up. And Luther, I forgot this, that Luther's like sick, I guess. He has like cancer or something.
Yeah.
Did they establish that in the previous film?
I do not remember that.
I didn't remember that being established, but.
But yeah, he's somehow sick. And.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, he's kind of like living, they're keeping him alive in this little bunker. And I think Gabriel, doesn't he say like someone that you love is going to die tonight?
Yeah.
Again. And Ethan realizes it's going to be Luther. So he runs to him And he
gets Tom Cruise running scene. He's running down the bridge in London, not the London Bridge, but the bridge that's like that's by Big Ben. That's like that goes across the town. He's hauling. And he's trying to get to Luther in time. And
And he makes it there, but Luther's already accepted his fate, and he says, you know, they kind of have a, you know.
Yeah, Gabriel locks him in a cage with a bomb, and basically Luther can like. It's like a 16 megaton nuclear bomb, and Luther can disarm the bomb to make it just a bomb that's going to sort of collapse the tunnels that they're in.
Yeah,
but it won't decimate the entire city. But he can't fully disarm the bomb in the amount of time that he has. And this was a moment that I know that the movie wants Luther and Ethan to have a parting emotional goodbye.
Yeah.
But I was literally sitting there. This is one of those movie tropes where I'm like. You have 2.5 minutes to get away from a nuclear bomb that Luther's trying to make less severe.
Yeah.
And he takes it down to 20 seconds before he starts running away. And I'm like, no, you're dead.
Yeah.
No, I know Tom Cruise can run really fast. Yeah. You can't run fast enough in 20 seconds to clear the blast radius of that thing.
Yeah.
Like, no. And I as I'm watching that, the movie is just prolonging this scene of him and Luther talking to each other. I'm going like, you don't have time.
Get out of there.
When you arrived, you were out of time. Like when you got there, it was too late and you needed to turn around and run.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. But they have it. And Luther says something before he dies. What does he say? He says, like, no one can stop. Oh God, I forgot what he says, but I think that actually calls back to the Phineas Freak, right? Like, you can't stop Phineas Freak, which I think he says in the first or the second movie. Yeah. I went back and read that and I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, cause I couldn't really remember it. Again, a little callback, but this is the end of Luther Stickle, he was the only other one that was in every other movie, even though he's only a cameo in 4.
Yeah. And if they make another movie and they say that Luther survived, I swear to God. Like, no, he did not.
It better not. No, he died.
We didn't see an on-screen death, but he's dead.
He's gone. He's dead. Luther's been a great character in these movies. He's awesome. So
And Luther's made this like poison pill that is for the entity. And there's this whole plan involving the submarine from the first movie where the submarine that we saw crash at the beginning of, not the first movie, but Dead Reckoning, movie 7.
Yeah.
We saw a submarine crash, and that's sort of like the origin point of the entity. It's like where the entity was unleashed first.
Yeah.
And they find out that they can get a drive from that thing, from that subway, if they can find it, where they can put this poison pill in and it will like force the entity to have to escape into this other drive. And that's sort of the plan. And it's all a very long shot because they have to A, find out where the sunken submarine is, B, get onto the submarine and retrieve the drive, which it's sunken in like the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah, like really far down the Bering Strait Sea. Yeah.
And then they have to get it, you know, all this. But they're on the move now. And is this when he decides to go to America, or is this when he breaks?
So I think he goes back and he tells like the president and the general and all the heads of, you know, the American intelligence what he needs, because he needs a ship. He needs and at some to go point, and find a ship.
We have the intro, like we have a really long prologue here. A lot of this stuff takes place in the prologue. When does it finally go to dun 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 dun? Like, when do we finally go? Is it before or after the party with Gabriel?
I want to say it's after. I think it's after.
Yeah, we got like a pretty decently sized. I think it's after Luther's dead too.
I think Luther dies
in the prologue, and then once Ethan's like, okay, well, here's the mission. Here's what we need to do.
Yeah,
we go into the opening titles, and then
we see all the generals and everything, and they're like, this guy did what? You know, that you see from the trailer. And they're like,
that's Holt McElhaney is one of the guys. Holt McElhaney I was in a TV show.
I was going to say, you were with him, right? So yeah, he's getting bigger, you know, and he's a good actor.
Yeah. One of my favorite videos I ever made was, I was doing a sketch with Jonathan Groff where I said, hey Jonathan, who do you think would win in a contest between you or me about who's better looking? And then Holt didn't know that we were doing like a bit, and he was in the front seat, and you can just hear him off camera going, out of you and Jonathan.
I remember that video. Because doesn't Jonathan just like move out of the way?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do one video where I go, hey, Jonathan, do you want to hang out after work tonight? And he just backs out of the camera. Like,
oh,
this.
Okay. Okay. Yeah,
and
yeah,
then
yeah.
The second was me going, hey, Jonathan, if we had a contest to see who was better looking, me or you, who do you think would win? And then Holt didn't know that I was like making a video. He thought I just asked him that. He's just in the front seat and he goes, out of you and Jonathan? And I just like start laughing because I'm like, it was a joke.
I gotta go find that video now.
Obviously, awesome. It's Jonathan.
Yeah. He's a very good looking man.
He's a very good looking man. So is Holt, but
He's gotten bigger in the last few years. Yeah. And I think that was that because it was Mindhunters, right?
Yeah.
And that really seemed to put him. He's been around forever, but that seemed to put him on the map. And he's been doing a lot. And so it's him, and then it's why do I always forget his name? Who we talked about before.
Nick Offerman. Sorry. Nick Offerman and the guy. There's also like the guy that like from Dead Reckoning who kind of looks like Steve Zahn. I never know what this guy's name is, but he like hates Ethan.
Yes. He's actually a big what is his
We found out in this movie that he's John Voight's son.
Yeah.
He's John Voight's son. Yeah, so there's so much, bringing things, which I am down with, but I'm also kind of like, Ethan Hunt didn't know that guy's son.
I know. Yeah. That was kind of like, I was kind of like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know about
it worked
that.
Worked out, but you could have taken it or you could have left it and it would have been fine. But
yeah,
that guy, it kind of gives him a little bit more motivation as to why he's so bent, like so hell bent on capturing Ethan.
Yeah,
gives him a little bit more backstory.
But I don't necessarily think that we need it.
I don't either.
There's always agents that just don't like Ethan because he's a gambler and he's insane and because he seems to just be lucky and doesn't actually. Yeah. It's like, dude, you're not like talented. You're like surviving on crazy whims of luck. You know.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we need. But we have that. Ethan decides. His best shot at accomplishing the mission is just to go straight to Mount Weather, where basically the United States military is hunkered down with their nuclear arsenal, knowing that all of these nuclear arsenals one by one are getting taken over by the entity. And they basically have like a 3-day doomsday clock on the wall. That's like in 72 hours, if the entity has taken over all of the world's nuclear arsenals, but ours, we will launch a preemptive strike and we will basically, in it as a defensive measure to the entity, we will like show that we're capable of acting. But Tom Cruise, who's kind of the only one who's seen it and who knows what its plan is, has to just go in there and be like, listen, guys, this is crazy. You need to give me an aircraft carrier on the ocean. You need to let me have just like unfettered access to like basically anything I ask for. And you need to tell all of your admirals on all of these vessels that they need to listen to me. Yeah. And the military guys are like, no, absolutely not. And I kind of like this, that Angela Bassett's like, sorry, I can't give that to you. Like, well, she basically says, well, she hands him a letter and she says like, I'm going to launch these nukes in 3 days. You better believe it.
Yeah.
And she tells him, and she tells the guards like, take Ethan in, keep him in holding for the next 3 days. And they send him out and you think like, oh geez, they didn't go for it.
Yeah.
But then as soon as they go out, the guards are like, all right, let's get you on the ship. Let's get you over to this aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
Carrier. And he's like,
So she kind of like fooled the other people into believing that she was against him, but she gives him a letter, which he doesn't really understand the meaning of, but basically it's like, go, you have 72 hours or I'm going to launch these nukes.
Yeah. And I kind of liked that she understands I'm not going to be able to do this with the approval of my council. I'm just going to have to go over their heads. And I think these are the things that give the movie stakes. Seeing like the president of the United States understand like in this situation where there's 3 days till likely the end of the world.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust this guy who time and time again has been able to do impossible things and hope that he's got one more trick left up his sleeve.
Yeah.
And like, what else am I going to do? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And he goes on the aircraft carrier and he sees Hannah Waddingham
from Ted Lasso.
Yes. From Ted Lasso, which she does a great American accent. The Brits are always better at American accents than the Americans are at Brit.
I just have a hard time believing Hannah Waddingham as like an American, let alone an American like general. I just was kind of like, okay, fine. Like, some of this casting literally seemed like Tom Cruise or Chris McQuarrie were like watching TV at home and they were like, hey, call that person.
Yeah, see if you want to be in the movie.
Call Hannah Waddingham. I like her. I just was kind of like, I don't know that.
I just think her accent is good. I was like, how's she going to pull off an American accent? And I was like, wow, she did a good job. But she gets a letter, which I actually, once I saw the date, it was May 22nd, 1996.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that must have been the original release date of Mission Impossible 1.
Probably.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was like, okay. But then they say, like, she says to Ethan, like, oh, this was a date where, you know, we had to make a risky decision and someone wouldn't take the risk and a bunch of lives were lost. So that was basically like the president.
Yeah, like the leadership wasn't willing to take the risk and we were trying to urge leadership to do it and they wouldn't do it. And now that we're the ones in the leadership positions, what she's saying to me is we got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So she gives, and she's not really in this movie very much, but she tells him basically about this submarine. They need to find the submarine and the only way to get there is to get to one, you know, a base in Alaska where... I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that I was like, I don't really get every single thing that's going on, but they need to get to Alaska.
Well, Tom Cruise writes in a notebook after he goes into the entity, SOSIS, and he hands that to Benji, and it's just the word SOSIS. And what that means is it's like the sonar something monitoring, you know, and it's there are these stations all over the world where people monitor radio activity with sonar, and there are these different, you know, and he's just saying you need to find the radio station closest to where this sunken submarine might have been because they'll have a report of it and we'll be able to pinpoint, we should be able to pinpoint its location. And they need to do all this analog. This whole time Ethan is separated from his team and they can't communicate. They can't talk over phones. Yeah. They can't over computers. So he just has to tell them where to go. You need to go to this radio tower in mm-hmm. Alaska and ascertain the report, and then you need to transmit it back to me over VHF frequency. And you know, and just let me know the spot, and then we need to meet up at the exact right time at the exact right moment in the same spot. And I'm going to be coming from under the ice and you guys are going to be above the ice. And we'll just hope that we're both there at the same time. And him explaining this plan to people, that he's like, they're like, so your team, who you're not in contact with, who you have no way of contacting, they're going to get information from a radio tower in Alaska, and they're going to get a location that they're going to transmit to us from VHS frequencies, and you're going to swim down to the submarine, get this thing, swim up, and they're going to meet you there? And he's like,
which this was actually good, because something goes on. He's got to jump into the water and he doesn't even know if the submarine captain is going to be there.
Oh, this was so cool. And again, this is another one of those moments of this moment. I loved the way that they because this was a moment of this whole sequence. I felt so much dread. Like from here on, the movie really starts cooking.
Yes.
When he jumps, so they basically take a big, huge like helicarrier out into the middle of the sea to meet up with this American submarine that's going to take him to the location of the sunken Russian submarine. And it's not surfacing. And this is a submarine that he's been told is unlikely to surface, that they don't really surface that often. So, and they're getting shot at by a Russian vessel. And so the helicarrier needs to go away and he just decides to just jump into the water with like a wetsuit on. And this is like the Bering Strait Sea and just hope that the submarine shows up.
Yeah. And he jumps in and luckily they are there. Like these people come up and they tase him, right? Or
I don't know why they would tase someone while they're in water. I'm like, that seems like a surefire way to kill him. You know, that was one of those movie things where I was like, you couldn't have just like, why do you need, just put him, like, you don't even need to incapacitate him. Just like throw an air mask on him and have him. I don't think they needed to do that. But I did like the way that they filmed this sequence, that the camera's kind of coming in and out of the water because there's waves. Cool. There's a storm. And then when like, he's like alone in the middle of the sea, which is also always like a very like palm sweaty thing. Yeah. The idea of being just like stranded in the middle of the sea. And it's also freezing cold water. Yeah. And the camera's coming in and out of the water. And when it pops back up, there's like two scuba divers that are like there next to him. And then it pops back up and there's like another one on the other side.
Yeah.
And then they tase him in the neck, which I don't think they need to do.
No,
but
But then
they take him to the submarine.
They take him down, and then he explains what you just said to the captain, played by
Tramell Tillman, dude.
Which this guy's got.
Dude, I love Tramell Tillman,
and I loved his character in this, because he tells him all of this crazy stuff, and you think he's gonna be like, you know, what's wrong with you? He's like, do you expect me to? I can't even remember. Do you remember what he says? Because the way he says it is basically like, do you expect anyone to believe that? And he's like, no. He's like, well, then you've got the right captain.
Like, yeah, he goes like this.
I'm your guy.
What he says to him is he goes, we're going to have to go over there. You know, like, we're going to have to risk being seen because we have to raise Periscope to go to Periscope depth so we can receive the VHF frequencies.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's like, well, if we do that, then the Russian submarines are going to notice us. And then they're going to, like, you know, he's like, so you're putting my men at risk. And he's like, I understand that. He's like, but that's the only way to do this. And he goes, well, if you want to poke the bear, you've come to the right man.
That's right.
You know, I just love his pace and his delivery. Yeah. I love when he goes, when he's like, you and your team were actually never, you and your decompression chamber were never part of my plan. And he's like, what exactly is your plan?
I love
how Tramell Tillman keeps calling him Mr. because he doesn't know his name. And he's just like, Mr., if you're talking about going down there, he's like, he's like, we'll do everything we can to help you, mister. I don't know what you're planning on doing, but you know, I thought
he played the character so well.
Oh, and yeah.
I like that they made him a little crazy, but like calculated crazy.
Do you know what have you seen Severance?
Yeah, I have. I haven't seen season two. I've just seen season one, but yes, I love him in that. Yeah.
Oh, and the story goes that Tom Cruise was watching Severance and he called Christopher McQuarrie and was like, get him. So they literally were just like, cool, Tramell Tillman, come play the submarine captain.
Right. Yeah.
And he kills it.
He does.
Absolutely. He's awesome. He's like such a highlight of a little cameo here.
Yep.
And I we have the classic Mission Impossible trope of like, explaining everything that could go wrong with Tom Cruise trying to dive down to this submarine and them explaining to him why, even with a decompression suit and a decompression chamber, he's still most likely going to die because of like the depth and the amount of time that he has, and them explaining to him, like, make sure you're breathing out the whole time you're surfacing because you'll get the bends and you'll die. And him trying to prep himself on the submarine by running on the treadmill with prep his lungs and just knowing, setting up, they do such a good job in this sequence of like setting up again, the stakes of what Ethan needs to do here is pretty darn next to not doable.
Exactly. It's pretty impossible.
Yeah.
But then we also are following his team with Benji and Grace and I guess her name is Paris. Those three, I can't remember if there's somebody else, but they head to Alaska.
There's the black guy that is.
Oh yeah, which I actually like that guy. I don't know. He was a good little addition.
Is he new or was he in Dead Reckoning?
He was in Dead Reckoning. He was partners with
The Steve Zahn guy.
The Steve Zahn guy, Shea Wingham. He was his partner, but he decided. I think his name is Greg Tarzan Davis. What a name. Tarzan. Wow. All right. Anyway, he's there with them as well. They go to this base in Alaska where they're supposed to be getting the recordings or finding out where this, you know, where they need to go.
Yeah.
And where the location of that Russian submarine is. And when they get there, there's a reveal. There's supposed to be somebody who's there. And we find out that the reveal is William Donlow, who was from the very first movie, the guy who created the CIA that they
Black
had
Vault.
To break in. The Black Vault, thank you, yes.
With the knock list.
And in the first movie, after all that happens, what does he say? What is...
I could not believe this. I watched the first movie and William Dunlow, we pick up with him 30 years later and he's been relegated to this, you know, radio surveillance shack in Alaska. And I thought... this was just something they wrote in to have this guy come back. No, I watched the first movie and immediately after Ethan and his team break into the Black Vault, Kittredge goes up to a guy and goes, I want that Donlow guy at a Radio Shack in Alaska by the end of the day. Yeah. I want him, you know. And I was like, what? I was like, that was in the movie? And then so like in movie one, they set up that Donlo has been sent to a SOSIS, you know, radio observation shack in Alaska. And we pick up with him 30 years later. He's married to like an Inuit woman, which is awesome.
It's great.
And but we also find out that the Russians beat Ethan's team to the punch and they're already there.
Yeah.
And the problem is like, so now they're kind of being held hostage in this base. And that's a problem for Ethan because there's a ticking clock. He's counting on his team to get those coordinates and to, you know, in a, like by a certain time. And if they're locked down with the Russians, they can't really do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're there. And so Tom Cruise is preparing for this jump. And then his other team, everybody else is there with the Russians. And there's this standoff. And this was a great cross-cutting scene.
Oh, this is great.
So Tom Cruise is there, and then all of a sudden, one of these, you know, one of the entities,
disciples,
like he starts attacking Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise has no idea what's going on, so he's fighting, and then everything goes off with the Russians because Don Lo is like, listen, they came in and they took everything, but like I memorized what the coordinates for the submarine were. And he's like, I was barely able to get it. So then basically everything kind of falls apart there. And so they're in this shootout with the Russians. And so you have these two scenes that are going on at the same time. And this cross cutting was great because they kept cutting and everything again is just like, oh my gosh, how are they going to get out of all of this? Right. Like the tension was so great.
Great live practical fight scene here with Tom Cruise and this guy and this on the submarine, really like solid fight choreography and like, and just, you know, kind of, again, like I think Tom Cruise just sells it really well and you know, I like him kicking this guy in the face.
Yeah.
And going, you're on the internet too much.
<You know>? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then who kills, does somebody kill that guy? Cause he
Don Love?
No. Does somebody kill the person that Tom?
Yes. Another one of the crew members of the submarine comes in and kills him.
Right. Right.
And again, and it's like throughout this whole franchise, Ethan's always getting like lucky breaks that somebody, you know,
I mean, but it also shows like, cause then the crew, it's good that they kill him because then the crew sees that like someone was infiltrated and they were, you know, so it kind of ups the stakes of like, oh, you never really see, but that's the only way that we get one of these disciples of the entity, which we said they probably could have used more, but basically then Don Lo, we think he's dead. Cause the cabin starts on fire. But everybody was able to get out, and Don Lo is doing, he finally gets the coordinates to the submarine captain with like, you know, 5 seconds left or whatever, you know. And
it's always that in these movies. It's always like at the last possible second, they finally transmit the coordinates. Yeah. But we find out, oh no, the coordinates are for literally the polar opposite spot on the globe. Yeah.
And then, but this was kind of a little cool thing because then the Russians go there. And then they realize like, oh, Tom Cruise is like, well, if it is the exact opposite, then that's what he meant to do, is to do the exact opposite so that the Russians would go away. So Don Lo, he's smart. He's a smart guy. He sent them in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Knowing that Ethan Hunt would realize that, oh, the exact opposite spot on the world is the location of the submarine. So they go there.
And so they start heading toward the submarine, but then they notice that one of the Russian subs saw them going that direction and started following them. And they're like, oh crap. And so Ethan comes up with this plan. He's like, here, get to the location, turn around and drop me off. And you guys head the other way and pull them away. But Tramiel Tillman's like, well, but if we leave, you have no place to decompress. Yeah. Yeah. Like the plan for in Tramiel Tillman's mind was Ethan will dive down using this really high tech decompression suit. Dive down to the submarine, get the drive, come swim back up just to where the submarine is, which is already a hard resurfacing, decompress in their state-of-the-art decompression chamber. And he's like, but if you don't have that, you're dead, you know?
Yeah.
But it's already been set up that Ethan's team has like an on-the-go decompression chamber, which is still like, bro, like you're gonna swim all the way up to the surface of the ice and hope that they're at the exact place you're at. And that they can, you know, and this movie's always this, I don't know how you felt when he opens up the door to go out into the ocean from this submarine. I immediately had this like pit in my stomach, like, dude, This is one of the craziest things that Ethan Hunt has ever done in this entire franchise. Like, dropping out of a submarine in the middle of the deep ocean, the deep Arctic ocean.
Yeah.
And also, like, the enormity of the Russian submarine that's right behind them when he like comes out and you just see this giant submarine that's like right in his face. And you're just like, oh my gosh. And the way that this whole sequence is handled, the score here, it's just sort of these low drones.
Yeah.
And the Ethan is like slowly just sort of moving past these giant objects, like this giant submarine. And he's barely missing the propellers of this submarine. Yeah. And then diving down into the abyss. Like, it's so, it gives me chills because it's like my worst nightmare to just be I've just got coordinates and I'm just going into like the black of the ocean with this suit on. Yeah. Isn't that terrible?
I hate it. Yeah.
Watching this sequence, I was just like, dude, like, and I know that this isn't like a practice. I know that Tom Cruise and the team aren't like actually deep sea diving. I know that they're shooting a lot of, but in the story, in the world of like what Ethan Hunt has to do right here.
Yeah.
That he's just got to dive into the darkness of like the black abyss of the sea and just hope he finds that submarine. And if he doesn't, it's like, you're just down there in the Bering Strait Sea.
Yeah, you're dead.
I just, in my body, I'm like, no, there's the ocean's not for us. We're not supposed to be in there.
Yeah. It terrified me. But yeah, like you said, the score, because that's what I was going to want to, that's what I wanted to talk about too. The scoring this is so good because it's just low frequency sounds and it's just really slow, but it made me cringe the whole time with fear. Like, oh, when is he going to do this?
Like, this whole sequence, I was going like, oh, in my chair. Yeah. I just kept going like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
So he's gone throughout the submarine and like he sees dead bodies that are in there because there's still some air in it. And he has to go get the what's it called? The Subkolva or something.
Yeah.
The Sevastopol's whatever.
He's got to get this, thing. This drive that's like the origin of the entity so that he can put Luther's poison pill into it. You know, it's a MacGuffin. But what happens is once he's on board this submarine, because this thing has been untouched for whatever it is.
Yeah, it was 2012.
Like
12 years or 14 years or something.
It's been sort of weighted the same way. But once he's like twisting knobs and stuff, it just changes the weight of the entire vessel just enough that the thing starts rolling.
Yeah.
And so now Ethan's in a rolling submarine that he's got that's rolling toward a cliff and it's going to drop all the way into the deep ocean.
Ugh.
And he's like, it's just like this whole sequence. You're like, dude, I love these shots of like him in chambers that are like half full of water
and
the water's just moving like this as the thing is. And he's just trying to like stay. He's just trying to move forward and like they do such a good job of just putting the pressure on and of giving you a sense of like how utterly isolating and scary and terrifying and anxiety inducing that would be.
Oh yeah.
You know?
And it just, the tension is really, really high. I liked how slow this scene was because I mean, he's underwater. You can't go that fast, but you know, a bunch of stuff is falling because it's turning and you've got missiles falling and like,
That room full of nuclear warheads that are falling on top of each other. And you're just like,
like, what the heck? Yeah. So it's like, and things are, you know, hitting doors. He ultimately does get into the room. He gets the MacGuffin and he gets what he needs, but he's like, his way out is gone. He can't get back. He can't get out the way that he came in. So he ultimately finds a chamber, like a torpedo chamber. Yeah. And he gets in, but he can't fit.
He can't fit his suit in. He's got this like decompression suit.
He like takes his suit. He takes the pack off and he tries to put it in, but like, it's still like nothing is really working. And like
this whole sequence just made me so physically uncomfortable that he finds the thing. You're like, okay, good. He's just going to get out the torpedo. But then like, he doesn't fit. And you're like, oh gosh. Like, you know, and all the while the submarine's still rolling, but then he just makes the decision to just cut his wetsuit off and just climb. And like, I just was imagining like the ice of that metal that
he's climbing
up that tube. And then the tube starts filling with water. And I just was like, I can't, like, no. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And this is one of those things where maybe the movie's asking us to suspend disbelief a little too. Because it's like, maybe. I think he's dead within a minute. I think he's dead within like 30 seconds.
Well, and they do say, like, because it's so cold, they said this earlier on in the movie, because it's so cold, it will slow down all your motor functions and we can save you. We have at least a little bit more time. So yeah, it's definitely like you would have been dead, but you're freezing to death. So
he basically has to swim to the surface in his underwear.
Yeah.
And
he doesn't make it.
And we watch him getting the bends and it's like, of course, like you were going to get the bends in the decompression suit.
Yeah.
It's like crazy. Yeah. And he just kind of hopes like maybe my dead body will just float to the surface and they'll be able to get the drive off of it. He's like, if I can just get myself close enough. And then, Agent Carter pulls him out of the ice and throws him into the decompression chamber. And of course he comes back to life because he's Ethan Hunt.
They kind of gloss over it. Cause like he has this vision of her like coming, which, I gotta say, I like Rebecca Ferguson. I liked that relationship a lot more. Like that rang so true. This last one with
little forced.
Yeah, Agent Carter's. It just doesn't. I like her as a character and I like her as an actor. But it just didn't hit. Like the Rebecca Ferguson one really worked really well. So I would have loved if that could have been that. But I digress. And so they have this weird like moment, and then he wakes up in the chamber, and they're like, she's in there with him for some reason.
And I guess this chamber is also like heated because they're both just not wearing clothes. And I'm like, sure, movie.
Why not? Go ahead.
Why not? It's Mission Impossible. Yep. Sure. And like that, I there's so much that I forgive in this film just because I'm so entertained.
Because that
underwater sequence was so gripping that I'm like, sure.
Yep. Like, don't think about it too much. Yeah. Like it's on to the next great. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, let's get to South Africa and wrap this thing up, you know?
Yeah.
So now they've got to get to this vault where it's basically like the only, like it's like a vault or like an ark that mankind built that would be a record of all their technology and their history if the world should ever go into nuclear, you know, apocalypse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're going to South Africa where this vault is, and they figure that's where the entity is going to hide itself once it launches all of the nuclear weapons in the world. And their plan is to kind of trap it. And I do like this too, that it's like they've got this drive that they can trap it in, but they need to pull the drive out as soon as the entity enters it. Otherwise it'll, and it's got to be in
a millisecond,
like 100 milliseconds. I think it was, it was like, and they've sort of established this thing with Agent Carter where she's a good pickpocket, and Ethan Hunt's like, this is your job. Blink of an eye.
Yeah.
As soon as that thing lights up, you got to yank it out, you know? Yep. So everything is, once again, it's like the stakes are
so high.
It's gotta be just so
exactly in the right time. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. So they established that they're going to, they need all this stuff to happen. But the important thing is he's got to put on the key, the poison pill. And then once it goes in, she's got to get it. Those are pretty much the important things. And they go to South Africa, and then they run into, it's kind of like everything happens because Kittredge comes in. Mm-hmm. He puts a wrench in everything.
Kittredge is there. Steve Zahn's there. Gabriel's there. Yeah. Everybody's there.
Yeah. And so everything kind of doesn't go according to plan. And Gabriel, okay. He's got like a few henchmen, but he's got this other guy why did they have this old guy? They have this like really, really old guy that's like, he's got like the button to like set the bomb off, because there's a bomb in there again. There's a nuke in there.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, he's got it. And I'm like, who's this old guy?
Who's that?
Like, it was just such a weird choice that, like, I don't know why they had that guy do it. But anyway, he's like a really old, very unintimidating man. And he's got the trigger to the bomb. Kittredge comes in and kind of messes everything up. The bomb starts counting down. There's like 10 minutes, you know.
Just like stupid Kittredge. It's like, do you really think you have a better plan than Ethan Hunt right now to save the world? What are you doing?
Yeah, like, you're an idiot.
Learn your lesson, Kittredge. Like, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, but I also like this little movie trope of like, Gabriel's like up on this giant rock in this cave, and he's easily 100 yards away from Ethan and his crew. And it's just one of these things where like, they're talking to each other like this.
Yeah.
Like, Gabriel's like, well, Ethan, it all comes down to this. And Ethan's like, you wouldn't do it. And it's like you guys, you're on opposite what? Sides of this cave. I know that there might be good acoustics in there, but like speak up.
Yeah. How can you hear each other?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, that was funny.
But anyway, they once again, the team has to separate. Ethan sends kind of Benji and the team, like, they're going to go into the Ark and make sure that they capture the entity. And
we did find out that Don Lowe is still alive.
Yeah.
And his wife is also still alive. So they're there with them.
His wife is great.
Yeah.
Great character. But Gabe kind of escapes with the drive and Ethan's got the poison pill.
Yeah.
And he's got to put them together. And so Ethan goes after Gabriel and they, you know, drive these Jeeps out of the cave. And
and
Gabriel's already announced that he's got an escape route, which is like, and again, I like the justification for the biplanes, because it's like they wanted planes that would be analog and disconnected from anything that the entity could infiltrate.
Yep.
And he says he brings two just in case, you know, they set that up.
Yeah.
And boy, this,
This ending is like, this is probably the cool, this was such a fun and thrilling ending. And like this whole sequence, once he gets on the plane, I was just totally in it the whole time. And I thought this is probably one of the coolest sequences in the entire franchise.
It's one of the coolest sequences I've ever seen in a movie ever.
It's amazing.
Like just knowing what was really going on practically, seeing some behind the scenes stuff that he is really hanging on and doing all of this stuff, and that it goes on for like 15 or 20 minutes.
Oh, it's
like,
a long time.
It is a protracted, long action scene where Tom Cruise is doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
It's not
just like, it'd be like in Rogue Nation, they take off and he hangs onto a plane.
And
that's crazy. It's wild. Yeah. This movie, he's like climbing all over the plane. He's climbing in and out of the cockpit. He's having fights.
They're doing barrel rolls and he's hanging on. He's got to change his orientation. Like
at one point he loses his grip and he's hanging on by his legs.
Yeah.
He's literally just holding onto the wing with his legs and he's upside down. And I was like, apparently he had an earpiece in and Christopher McQuarrie had to keep going, "Tom, you're smiling too much." Because that's how crazy he is that he was just having a great time hanging off of these planes. And he kept going like, "Tom, remember, like it's,
you're not having fun.
And he kept being like, yeah, you're right. And like, I got to lock in. But he kept like laughing and smiling because he was just having a blast.
That's crazy.
Because he's such an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
But
well, I guess he had to like change how he was breathing because there's so much wind in your face. Anyway, you can tell he is physically having a hard time.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Every time they cut to a wide shot of what's going on, I was just like, dude,
that's so crazy. And I do love that this feels so old Hollywood in the best way.
Yeah.
Cause like, you know, like you'd have trains and somebody would be on a train, you know, like Buster Keaton would do this stuff and it's like on a train and it's like, wow, that's pretty amazing that he did that. You know, they've got these biplanes that are just old. It just feels very old Hollywood, but it feels so, I mean, you can feel everything. Just like you said, every time they do a wide shot with all the wind and everything, he is falling. Like it looks extremely difficult.
Well, and again, I think that the planes being old and the analog, this is all thematic. Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise are definitely making a statement with this film to the film industry and to audiences that they're like, hey, maybe you guys don't like our old school. Maybe we are a dying breed, but we're going to go out swinging and we're going to go out like with a bang.
Yeah.
And this whole sequence is such a good tribute to the entire franchise.
Oh, absolutely.
It's such a good tribute to like practical filmmaking that it's just like, what's the biggest swing we can take?
Yeah.
So Tom Cruise starts out this sequence on one plane. He punches the pilot of that plane out, takes over the
plane. The real old guy.
Yep. He flies the plane up underneath Gabriel's plane and then climbs out of his plane and climbs onto Gabriel's plane from his plane. It's so crazy. And then he has this whole long fight scene with Gabriel where he's like trying to rock him off of the plane and he's trying to shake him and at one point Tom Cruise finally gets like a position where he's like holding down the rudder of the wing and won't let Gabriel steer.
Yeah.
And knowing that Tom Cruise is doing all this stuff is so crazy. And seeing the wide shots of it and like, it just keeps going and going and going. And the only moment where we see something that looks like a green screen is once the actor playing Gabriel is out of the plane too. Yeah. And he's hanging from the plane.
Yeah. He grabs his arm and he breaks his arm.
Which I loved this arm break.
I thought it was pretty cool. Yeah.
It's awesome.
He like grabs arm and he just totally breaks it. And the Gabriel is screaming and they do a wide shot. And it is very, very apparent that it is green screen because obviously this other actor is sane. And
yeah, he's not.
He's not going to put his, you know,
he's not doing that.
Do what Tom Cruise did. And that's
but I
like,
really, yeah,
but
I
it gives you this huge, it gives you this, like, you see, like, everything else has been real. And this other green screen, even though it looks good for a green screen, it's like, you could tell it's totally fake, which makes Tom Cruise's thing even more amazing.
This arm, but yeah, this arm break was gnarly. He's using basically the force of the wind. Like he basically, because he's been hanging on for dear life this whole time. And he basically is like, I'm going to let go and just hold on to your arm. And I'm just going to yank your arm back and just yank it out of its socket. And it's just like, oh, like, and then I also loved in this final sequence, like they're both kind of hanging out of the plane and Tom Cruise is trying to regain control of the cockpit. And Gabriel's like, he's like, you don't have a parachute. I have a parachute.
Yeah.
And I thought this was so funny and awesome. Him like letting go and being like, good luck, Ethan. And he like, let's go. And then his face just slams into the like rear rudder of the plane and it just like splits his skull in half.
Yeah. And he dies. I thought it was like such a weird way to kill him.
I thought it was awesome.
It felt very like Naked Gun. Like, good luck. And then he's. Yes, into the rudder. I was like, wow.
But okay, I think it was one of those things where it's like, bro, you're not Ethan Hunt. You can't.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
you know,
it was like, yeah, you're dead.
Yeah.
So
you're dead, bro.
But yeah, he has to regain control all the while, which we haven't said yet. All while this is happening, everything back at the bunker, Don Lowe realizes that he can just defuse the bomb, but just like Luther, there's gonna be an explosion. But we find out that they have 10 seconds to run into the server room, which they'll be safe. So that's fun. And then, so Paris and Agent Carter and Benji all have to go into the server room, and Benji has been shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really liked this sequence because you're not sure if Benji's going to make it or not. You know, like he could definitely die, but he has to walk Paris through how to keep him alive so that he can walk Grace through what she needs to do to get everything ready for the entity.
Yeah. And he kind of he has Paris do surgery on him to like help a collapsed lung.
Yeah.
And then while he's kind of in and out of consciousness, he's explaining to Grace what, you know, and it's like, he keeps like passing out and then like coming, you know?
Yeah.
And,
which I thought Simon Pegg did a great job in this.
Yeah.
As I mean, he realizes he could die, but he's got to keep everything going. And they slap him at one point. He's like, hey, what? He managed to bring the comedy in, which was good.
Yeah. Once Gabriel's off this plane too, that we're cutting back, and this is, you know, great. We're cutting back and forth to these two different things. Once Gabriel's off the plane, Ethan realizes that the plane's on fire and that it is diving and it's going, you know, and he can't regain control of it. So he decides to, there is another parachute, I guess. And he decides to jump. Parachute is on fire. And this was so crazy that he's in the air, Tom Cruise, who's a great skydiver, is trying to put this poison pill onto the, but also like he pulls the parachute. It doesn't work. It's burnt, you know, it catches on fire. And so then he's falling with this, he tries to pull the reserve. And basically what we see of Ethan Hunt is that he's falling into kind of clouds and it looks like he doesn't have a reserve chute or anything like that. And he's basically going to make the sacrifice play and be like, as long as I can get this poison pill in this drive before I hit the ground, we've got a shot, you know. And we don't see what happens with Ethan. What we see is what we're waiting for is like this light to turn on that means that the poison pill is in place.
Yeah.
And what we see is right as the bomb's about to go off, the light goes on, Grace gets the entity trapped in the drive and the bomb goes off and everybody makes it to safety. I'm curious to know your thoughts here, because my personal preference for the end of this film is Benji and Ethan should die. I think Luther, Benji, and Ethan all make the sacrifice and they go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
All three of them go out and they all are heroes who saved humanity. And that's the end of our story. And I think, unfortunately, doing the thing where it's like, Ethan lived. He was able to pull the reserve shoot, and he makes it like we could always come back. And I'm like, don't though.
Yeah.
Don't.
I totally see where you're coming from. I'm kind of torn on it because it's like, okay, spoilers for James Bond, the last James Bond that they did with Daniel Craig. They kill him, right? Mm-hmm. Like they kill James Bond. And I'm kind of like, did you really need to do that? Like, I know it's his last one. So but that movie was executed in a different way.
Right.
And this movie, like, I could see his death. Because, I mean, Tony Stark dies, right? And it's like, that felt so fitting. Mm-hmm. And having Luther, Benji, and Ethan die could have been like, that feels very appropriate. But I wasn't like, so I'm kind of like in the middle. Like, I'm fine that they lived.
If someone's going to live, maybe Benji to me is like the
one.
Yeah,
I can see that. Yeah.
Like Benji makes it through. Because to me, it's like, what we've really established after we did Mission Impossible 3 last, and I said this could be an ending to this franchise. Ethan rides off into the sunset, he leaves the IMF, and he gets married.
Right.
What we find out in Ghost Protocol is that was never gonna work. It's never like Julia was gonna be in danger being married to Ethan, and he realizes that his life is in the field and that he's not able to have relationships like the one that he wanted to have with Julia.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this tragic life, similar to like the one James Bond has, where it's like, you don't really get to have those personal relationships. So there's not really anything for Ethan to look forward to in like retirement. It's like, he's just gonna, you know, like, I feel like Ethan Hunt feels like a character who's fated to die in the field, saving the world. And what a better way to go out than like this film, you know, buying Earth another chance against our foibles with our technology and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It just felt like that could have, we could have, just said job well done, Agent Hunt, and you know,
you definitely could have. And I don't, you know, I don't know, I am positive that they considered for sure that ending. Mm-hmm. And maybe they even shot it and they could have tested it, and maybe it tested really bad. Because Tony Stark's death, like, it was set up and it just worked really, really well. James Bond's death didn't really work well, in my opinion. So this one is kind of like, okay. So again, that's kind of why I'm like, yes, that would have been a great ending. But also like how it ended, I was fine with. Because I think it's more like Ethan, it seems very much like Ethan is done. He's like, I'm good. Like, I'm out. But yeah, hopefully they don't bring him back and do another one. You know, like that would make this ending bad.
I mean, I'll go see it.
I will too.
Like, I'll go watch 65-year-old and 70-year-old Tom Cruise keep at it.
Yeah.
But I just feel like this is a solid ending for this 30-year franchise. And I think let it end. Let it be a nice, you know, solid capstone. There's a moment here in this ending sequence where, you know, Ethan kind of gets congratulated by Kittredge and different people.
Where
the Steve Zahn guy, who's, I guess, John Voight's son, does this thing that I was just like, that's so stupid. He walks up to him and points a gun at him.
Yeah.
And then puts the gun aside and shakes his hand. And I was like, that's so dumb. that he's like, hey, job well done. And I was like, hey, how about don't point a gun at me right now? Like,
just fell from the sky, dude.
It's like if you were just gonna come over here to shake my hand, like the movie, it's like this thing where the movie's like, oh, he's gonna shoot him. He's still mad at him. He's gonna shake his hand, and it's like, but that's just dumb. That's just like a thing that I don't think a person would do. Yeah. I don't think any person would ever be like, hey,
yeah,
nice,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. And it was very.
Yeah, I was like, the movie, for sure. Yeah. And I was like, okay, whatever movie.
Well, and we did forget, there's a whole thing going on with the president.
Oh, we missed all that stuff,
which actually I thought was great, because everybody's telling her, listen, you need to launch a preemptive strike, and we need to sacrifice one of our cities to show that, like, we got hit or something, right? Like, we're not just killing everybody just to do it. So, like, she is faced with this huge problem of like, okay, which city do I take out of our own? Cause they give her like the top cities in the US, and, you know, I'm going to kill all these other people. So she has this huge decision that she has to make. Ultimately,
they say it's like 100 million people that are estimated to die by this decision. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, Everyone's telling her what to do. And then she ultimately says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take all of our nukes offline.
Yep.
Which I mean, it's executed so much better in the movie.
It's very similar. She says something that's very similar to The Dark Knight, where when the guy goes, I'm going to do what you should have did 10 minutes ago.
You know,
she says, I'm going to do what we should have done from the start, which is let's just take the silo offline. Let's take the arsenal offline and let's just not let the entity get in, you know? And when she does that, one of her Secret Service agents is like, no, like you're going to like this decision is going to, and I don't necessarily know that this is like a cult member of the entity cult. I think he's just a guy who's like, I disagree. And since there's no time to like voice my disagreement, I'm just going to have to take matters into my own hands and kill you.
I thought it was one of the cult members.
Could be.
But yeah, they don't get into it much. But this whole time we think Nick Offerman is one of the cult members because he asks for a gun. Like he's like, soldier, give me your gun. And we're like, oh, crap. But he's the one who ends up taking out the other agent.
Yeah.
And he sacrifices himself, which this was also one thing that I was like, okay, that didn't land. Like, I don't even know who Nick Offerman is. Like, I don't really care.
Was also just like, it was kind of weirdly acted.
I was like,
I like Nick Offerman a lot, but he's just kind of like, ugh.
Yeah.
did this really dramatic death that I was like, all right.
Which, I love Nick Offerman as well. I think he's a great actor. But yeah, this one was like, I didn't really get it.
Yeah, but I do like this idea of like, this decision is so important that people would be willing to kill you if they disagree with you,
right?
Because the stakes are that high.
Yeah,
and I feel that in that moment and in that scene, and I feel that throughout the entire movie. But yeah, our guys win, and they defeat the entity for now, and they all, you know, kind of smile at each other, and like, I think it's like Trafalgar Square or something, or Piccadilly Circus maybe, or something. And they all walk off into the distance, you know, and that's the end of the movie.
That's the end, and we'll see if it's the end of the franchise. We'll never know until they announce it. So
we're going to get into our scores for Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. We give scores on this podcast out of 10, 10 being the best. We score the technical rating of the film, which is like the craft of the film, the writing, the construction, the, you know, technical aspects, the acting, the score, the musical score. We score the ending. How well did the movie stick the landing? We score for rewatchability. How likely are you to rewatch this? How likely are you to enjoy rewatches of this film? We give a score for cultural relevance and impact, and we give a score for our subjective feeling about the movie. How we just subjectively enjoyed the film. So Kramer, what is your technical rating for Mission Impossible 8, The Final Reckoning?
My technical score is a 9. And it could be anywhere, just because like all the stunts, it's so much of the actual technical style of filmmaking and the analog style of filmmaking that they did. I think it is so well done. And then, you know, the acting is amazing. Like Tom Cruise gives a great performance. All the other actors give a great performance. There's definitely a lot of cheesy parts, as we've talked about. Definitely a lot of parts that are like, okay, and it kind of drags a little bit. But everything else is so good. I can't see, you know, like it just outweighs everything else. Like the cheesiness and the stupidity of some of the things I totally overlook because everything else is so good and so entertaining. So, yeah.
You basically had my exact same response, which is like the technical aspects about this film that work are so good that they make up for so much of the other stuff that you could criticize. I was tempted to give this a movie a 10.
Yeah.
Because that's how good the stunt work is, the action, the execution. Yep. I'm so impressed with what they did. It's so hard to not give them a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
But when we are looking at the technical score of a film, we are trying to rate everything, you know, the writing and there are, you know, there's moments in here that didn't land for me, and there's moments that are cheesy. And if the other stuff wasn't so good, I might have this at like an 8 or a 7.5, but it's so good in the aspects that work that I have it at a 9, where I'm like, I'm only docking 1 point for some of that stuff that, you know, like the gun and the handshake or the prolonged conversation between Luther and Ethan that feels like it goes on for too long, or maybe one too many flashbacks in the first act.
Yep.
I'm forgiving all of that because that submarine sequence and the airplane sequence are so good that they basically kind of, I just am like, how can you not give that as high of a rating as possible?
Yeah.
So how about the ending of this film?
The ending, I gave a 9.5. It just, as we talked about, this whole sequence was so well edited, so well acted, so well choreographed. Everything was just total. It was such a fun ride to see the end of this movie. And I think the taking off half of a point more for kind of like Nick Offerman's death didn't really land. And like the really old guy that's riding the plane, I didn't really get, you know, but
I don't know who that is.
Yeah. Like, so, but it was so much fun. Loved it.
We are 2 for 2. I'm 9.5 as well, where I'm like, I very easily could give this ending a 10 because it's just such a thrilling ending. But my personal preference is like, I kind of want Ethan Hunt to die just to give the franchise finality and know that. And I think that it would be thematic and it would work. And that's my preference. And like, you know, I'm just like little nitpicky things, but it's as close to a 10 as it could be. And I'm just docking half a point there.
Yeah.
How about the rewatchability of this film?
Rewatchability, I gave an 8.5. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing is because I think as you continue to rewatch this film, it is long. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like overly long. Like they definitely could have made it shorter, but there's a lot of flashbacks, a lot of things that could probably get a little bit more corny as you watch it. But I want to rewatch it. And I think it you could rewatch it. And these sequences are so much fun to watch. So
I'd like to go see it again before it leaves theaters, to be honest. Yeah. I'd like to experience it one more time in theaters. I gave it a 9 because this whole franchise is just a very rewatchable franchise. It's just, it's something I come back to every few years. And I'm like, every time they have a new one coming out, I'm always like, oh, let me check back in with the Mission movies. And every time I revisit them, I'm like, yeah, this is just I said this during when we were talking about 3, this is just a franchise that goes down smooth.
Yep.
It's just like, it's just an easy watch. It's fun. It mostly all works.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise is always killing it.
Yeah.
He's just always like so entertaining and so watchable. How about cultural impact?
I don't know if I should do this higher or not. I gave it a 9 because it is the culmination of everything. This has been such a successful franchise. And I mean, like you said, every movie is really, really good besides 2, but like they doing 8 movies and having the vast majority of them be really, really good is an extremely hard thing to do.
And 2 is like,
it's still fun.
It's just a very stylized film.
Yes.
It sort of just feels like it belongs in a different
world.
Yeah. But there's still stuff in there. Like like that opening of Tom Cruise free climbing in Moab is insane.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Cultural impact. I gave it a 9 because I feel like, you know, I actually think this is probably going to mark the end of an era. Not just the era of the Mission Impossible franchise, but the end of an era of a certain style of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think that Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise were very aware of that while they were making the film. And I think that in time, you know, in generations to come, filmmakers, they're going to talk about like what this franchise meant to the industry and what Tom Cruise meant as a movie star. And this is such a like great example of who he is and what he does.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all there. And I think that this movie's going to continue to have a place in the hearts and minds of fans for years to come.
Absolutely.
Where's your subjective score at?
My subjective score is a 9.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this movie. Like I said, just me and my son went and it was such a great theater experience and it's such a fun movie. The problems, you know, are why I docked off the one point that we've talked about, but just such a great movie and a great way to end a franchise like this. Like, it's crazy how you can top all the things that have happened in this franchise, but this is right on par with all of them. And that plane sequence was absolutely amazing. So
I'm at a 9.5 subjective score.
Nice.
All the criticisms that I absolutely had of it in my head as I was watching it kept getting erased by how much fun I was having.
Yeah.
I just kept not caring because I was like, but it's, I'm just having a great time.
Yep.
You know, when I watch a Fast and the Furious movie that comes out lately, I can't ignore the many criticisms that I have while watching those films.
Yeah.
Because the action scenes don't like make up for it. They almost make it worse. Like the action scenes happen and I'm like, this is maybe the worst part. Like I can't go like, well, this was so well executed that, but that these mission movies, anytime I have an issue with anything story-wise or script-wise or performance-wise, they'll get into a set piece where I am just completely immersed and transfixed and blown away by what they're doing on a technical level. Yeah. And then by the end of the movie, I'm like, I don't really care about any of that stuff. That movie was awesome. I'm at a 9.5. We had very similar scores for that film. Have you seen it? Weird if you watched this podcast. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Go see it again. Let's help this movie be profitable. Let's, send this franchise out with a bang.
Yeah.
Next week, we will be talking about the movie Friendship, the Tim Robinson and Paul Rudd film. Go see that if you haven't, if you would like to watch along with the podcast. We already saw this film and we already recorded this episode.
We did.
And it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
We had a really good time with Friendship.
We did. And go see that movie. It's really, really well, if you like Tim Robinson.
Yeah.
And if you, or if you look him up and realize and like his comedy, go see that movie in the theater. It's great.
Yeah. But that's it. Let us know what you think in the comments and, like, share, comment, subscribe, all that good stuff. As always, we will see you next time.